And we are on. Good afternoon and welcome to week 56. Oh boy, you know, no one is sighing more than Job. He's like, if you get to the end faster, I get out of this faster. I don't know what I am to Job. We are in the fourth speech of Elihu. Remember that Elihu initially told us in his first speech, after he got through his introduction and, you know, beration of all the other visitors, he said, you, Job, say, God doesn't communicate. God does communicate. He sends messages in dreams. He sends messages by striking people. Then you say that God is not just. God is benevolent and just. His benevolence to society shows that he is not destructive. His protection of society from the mighty shows you that he is fair. That was in his second speech. Then his third speech, he said, you say there's no point in being good. Whether Job actually said that or not is irrelevant. But you say there's no point in being good. But God responds to the way that you treat other people. When other people cry out because you have harmed them, God is going to respond. And the other point that he emphasized in general in his speeches was repentance. That Job should pray to God, that he should express, to acknowledge what he's done and express regret for what he has done, and accept that he's not going to repeat it. In this last speech, he begins with what really has seemed like more or less a recap of the ideas he had expressed earlier. In chapter 36, we are, if you're using the Stone Tanakh, at the very bottom of page 1667. He began with his traditional, wait, I have things to say, you know, don't pull me off stage just yet. And then he shifted to say, God communicates by protecting and punishing as appropriate, something we've already seen. We have a little bit more to see in chapter 36 before we get into the big news, which is chapter 37. And 37 is the end of what Elihu has to say, and there he is going to do something new, and I think something very important. So we are in chapter 36, sentence 16, and the theme of the next few verses, 16 to 21, is don't give up hope, Job, because God is actually helping you by causing you pain. That's his theme. Suffering can help. Number one, by informing you of wrongdoing. Right? He tells you what you're doing wrong when he makes you suffer. And number two, by saving you from worse punishment later on, this world or next world. Let's take a look at sentence 16, please. Chapter 36, sentence 16. Again, if you're using the art scroll, it's the very bottom of 1667. He says, Ve'af, and also, because he's adding to what he had just said before that, Ve'af hasischami pitzar, rachav lo mutzak tachteha, v'nachas shulchanacha malei deshen. This is a hard sentence to translate. He says, God helps you with your pain, or through your pain, meaning, hasischami pitzar. What is the word lahasit? I know this word. A mesit?
To seduce,
right. To seduce, to persuade.
To allure,
okay.
To entice,
right. These are all appropriate words for it. A mesit in the Torah is somebody who convinces people to worship idols, who lures them into idolatry. So he says, "V'af hasischa or hasitcha mi pitzar, God is drawing you away from the enemy. Rachav lo mutzak tachteha. This is a very hard phrase to translate. This rachav lo mutzak tachteha. The art scroll renders it as, well, first of all, he has led you out, which led I don't think is strong enough, but from a constricted entrance into a broad place with no narrowness at its bottom. The constricted place is the tsar, pi tsar, something that is tsar, is narrow. Right? That's one of the explanations that's offered regarding Mitzrayim, is that it is this very narrow, constricted place. So, Ve'af hasischami pitzar, he has lured you out of the narrow place, rachav lo mutzak tachteha, to put you into a rachav, a place that is broad, that is spacious. Lo mutzak tachteha, mutzak he's taking, the art scroll is taking as something narrow. Alternatively, it could be a place that is hard. But he's putting you into a better place. V'nachas shulchanecha malei deshen, you will have a table full of plenty. This is how God is helping you. He's bringing you to a better space. How is he bringing you to a better space? Take a look at source number one, where Rashi says, "Bilachat shehivi alav." With the pressure that God brings upon this person, and Rashi is really referring to sentence 15, but it applies to what we're seeing here. With the pressure he brings upon this person, megale es ozno, he opens his ear. He opens the person's ear. Lemor shuv elai, saying, return it to me. It inspires repentance. That's the idea that Elihu is trying to express here in chapter 36, sentence 16. He says, you, Job, this is actually helping you. And Rashi is building on also source number 2, which is a Gemara in Menachos. It's part of a longer piece, but I just pulled out the part that was most directly relevant for us. And it says, Midas basar vadam. When you deal with flesh and blood, So what do people do? Adam meisit et chaveiro midarkei chayim ledarkei mita. A person seduces another person from life to death. Meaning that people tend to draw others into destruction, into that which is going to ruin them. Then usually the term meisit is used for a negative type of persuasion. Whereas Hashem seduces a person from death to life. Shenamar, as the pasuk says, "V'af hasischami pi tsar." He seduces you away from the mouth of tsar. What is tsar? We said narrow, but the Gemara's play on it is "Migehinom shepiha tsar shashanat savur besocha." From Gehenom, Gehenom being the term that we use in the Gemara for what is usually called in English hell. From Gehenna, which has a narrow, that's the word tsar, mouth, it's smoke stored up inside it. It's like an oven. If you picture a classic old oven, which gets narrower towards the top, in order to concentrate the smoke inside, that's what this place is like. So when it says that God is drawing you away from tsar, he's drawing you away from Gehinnom, this place of punishment. And the Gemara, as I said, goes further with it. I just brought the most simple piece of it. So what Elihu is trying to say is that God is actually trying to help you with what he is inflicting upon you. You may not like what he's saying, but that's what he's saying. That brings us to sentence 17. We're going to this whole section here, 16 to 21, is all about this. 17 is at the top now of page 1669. He says, "Vidin rasha malesa." Din umishpat yismochu. He says, the din of the wicked you have completed. Din is what? Judgment, right? The punishment that is meted out for the wicked, you have filled it, meaning you received your fill. Instead of male dashen in the previous sentence being full of richness and comfort, you have been filled with the punishment of the wicked, din u'mishpat yismochu. But that din and mishpat, that judgment, is actually going to support you now that you have been through it. You're going to have a happy ending. Ki chema pen yisischa besafek, v'rav kofer al yateka. He says, don't let anger, chema, draw you, persuade you, seduce you. That's the yisischa again. Bisafek. Safek is a word he's used before, like us bimelo sefek we talked about. Safek means quantity. That's right. So in this context, it's not. It's actually quantity. He's used it a few. Yehovah's used it a few times that way. You're right, though. Often it does mean that, but here it's not. He says, "Don't let anger sway you. due to the great quantity of suffering you have experienced. V'rav kofer, kofer is often used as wealth or ransom, a payment. And don't be swayed, on the other hand, by the promise of wealth, that you're going to receive something if you stray from God. Don't become so angry at God that you reject God because of your anger. And don't get drawn in by promises of wealth elsewhere. You should stay loyal to God. And he says in Pasuk Yutet, sentence 19, and in general, 19 and 20 are very hard to render. There are a lot of different ways to read it. I'm going to give you Mitzudat David on the sheet and pray that that is sufficient. Hayaroch shuacha lo vitzar v'chol ma'amatzei koach al tish'av halayla la'alos amim tachtam. This is very, there's no way around it. These are very hard sentences. Take a look at Mitzudat David, which I brought you in source number 3. He says, v'chi yiyeh shraratcha, I suppose would be the way to read that word, aruch umetukan, it's with a shin, not a sin. The aruch umetukan, mibli takdim latzara. He says, should your strength be arrayed and established without any suffering, strong blows and mighty suffering first, if you would continually have good, if you would have perpetual good, the result is that you would kick out at God because you have plenty. Vitovada dead, and you would be lost forever. Al tit avet saracha shucha kalaila asher ba al haakum listalek min haolam. Do not long for the night that befalls the idolaters, causing them to leave this world. In other words, what he's saying is, this is sort of a different argument. His first argument was that when God zaps you now, so you have taken your punishment, and you've also learned a lesson, and therefore ultimately you will benefit. What he's saying now is, you can't expect that life is going to be all, you know, what's the expression? Bowl of cherries? Yeah.
A bed of roses.
Bed of roses, thank you. You can't expect that life is going to be wonderful for you and there's going to be no suffering involved. He says that's not the way it works. And if you long for a life like that, you should be aware you're longing for the darkness and night that befalls those who don't walk with God. As I said, there are many other ways you can render this sentence. Rashi, building on Medrash Tanchuma, does another approach. Dat Mikra does another approach. Ibn Ezra and Rabbag have yet another approach. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Mem Daled Amud Beis, has another approach. I picked one that I felt was consistent with the general context and would be simple to see in terms of how it fits into the words. That's what I was going for in choosing Mitzudat David, and I think his approach does do that. I also wanted to make sure to note, though, for you, the opening words of sentence 19. They sound familiar in the Hebrew?
Is it a song?
No. Hayaroch shuacha. Does that sound at all familiar?
That's yours from Psalms.
It's from Job, but the phrase, yes, it's true. You will find it, but that's not actually what I'm going for. Liturgy. Another piece of popular liturgy that should be credited to Job. Hoshanos. The Hoshanos that are said on Sukkot, one of the Hoshanos is Eroch Shui. Eroch Shui, I will arrange my prayer. That's the beginning of it. So that's right from here. Hayaroch shuacha. That's where it's pulled from. The intersection of people who have learned Job and said Hoshanos is small. That's the problem. But you need a little Venn diagram here. So that's the idea. So what Eliyahu is trying to say to him, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't do his last sentence in the unit. He says, Hishomer, be careful, al tefen el oven, do not turn to corruption, ki al zeba charta me oni. He says, what you should do is stick with God. You should stick with God, who has been close to you, when you have suffered. You have chosen God to be with you in your suffering. Al-Zeb Baharta is talking about God. You have chosen God to be with you in your suffering. So that concludes his statement about suffering being good for you. And in fact, really, you could read that as the end of his fourth speech and the beginning of a fifth one now. He's going to go in an entirely different direction. So for those who are uncomfortable with the idea that suffering is good for you, that's over with now. Now he's going to go in an entirely different direction and an important direction to grasp. Yes, Paul?
Did you comment on that last line, do not desire the lack of trouble which befalls idolaters?
Yeah, that's what I said. That if you desire a life with no suffering, what you are looking for ultimately is the end which is going to befall those who are not with God, because that will bring night upon you. Yes?
No, but that's the lack of trouble which befalls all.
You're, by desiring not to suffer, you're actually desiring greater suffering. That's what he's saying.
The black trouble which befalls idolaters is after the fact.
Correct. Right now, they look like they're doing well, but they're going off a cliff. Oh, none of it is obvious. That's for sure. Yes, Ralph.
This hasn't been incorporated into rabbinic tradition, has it?
What? What he said? What hasn't been?
That we benefit from suffering.
Oh, of course it has. Of course it has. The again, I go back to what I said when we started the book and we did our brief overview of various approaches within the Talmud to suffering. But absolutely, one of the approaches is that this ultimately benefits you, whether it is benefiting you as an educational experience or whether it's meant to benefit the person because it is punishing them for something so that they won't have to be punished, you know, worse in another world. Yeah, the idea is absolutely there. Does that mean that all cases of suffering fit it? No.
It's pretty harsh.
Yes. Absolutely harsh. I'm not going to sugarcoat. That is absolutely a view. It is not the only view, and it is not meant to apply to all cases of suffering, God forbid. But it is a view, and it has prominent voices behind it, besides Elihu. Yeah, no, there absolutely is such a concept, for sure, yes.
No, I have heard people talk like this, that they have had I was doing some volunteer work at the Cancer Society, and I was there with all my educational stuff, and this young man came up to me, and he said, this is going to sound very strange to you, but cancer is the best thing that ever happened to me. It changed my life. And he recovered.
I mean, the big difference, right? The big difference between the young man who you describe and Elihu is that Elihu is talking about somebody else. In other words, the young man can say that about himself and say, this was good for me and I am better for the experience. But saying that like Elihu is to Job, you know, is cruel.
No, I know what you're asking.
Yeah. In the same way, I think I must have mentioned this at some point this year. Shlomo Kluger, who actually was quoted at the Haggadah night last night, he had a grandson who was also named of Shlomo Kluger. He was also a rabbi, I believe. And he lost both parents at a very young age. And in his eulogy for his father, he talked about how there are various passages in the Talmud that speak about the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem and say it happened because of this and it happened because of that. And he says there's a real risk when you do that. He's saying this as part of his eulogy. He says when you say things like that, it dehumanizes the sufferer. And it also allows everybody else to sort of feel better. Like, oh, well, that's why it happened. You know, like when, you hear about somebody who was in a car accident and you hear, well, they weren't wearing a seatbelt. Like, that becomes an excuse for the suffering, and now people don't have to feel so bad because, you know, the point that I think he makes there very powerfully, especially because of the context in which he's speaking, is that someone like Elihu, who is willing to say to somebody else, well, you're suffering, but it's because you did X and now you're going to know better. Or this is meant to atone. You know, he's not seeing Job as a person. He's seeing Job as a case in a textbook.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
he hasn't suffered himself, presumably.
Well, that I don't know. I will not presume to know what Elihu has experienced.
I don't understand how Job is just not responding to this. Has he just turned off?
That's a really good question.
Not paying any attention.
So Ralph asks the question that we asked without asking in the beginning of Elihu's speeches in chapter 32, which is, why is nobody answering him? And no one's going to answer him. God isn't going to answer him either. God is going to answer the other visitors. He's not going to answer Elihu. And that's one of the reasons that motivates some people to say that the Elihu speech is actually put in after. In other words, the book is without these chapters, chapter 32 versus to chapter 37.
Is that so the rabbis could follow through on it? The rabbis could take up this idea and run with it?
No. The idea is that there is, at some point, there's a book which has this story minus Elihu, and somebody feels this needs to be said. And therefore, we're now going to put it in before the canonization. In other words, this is our book. If someone was looking to find a place in biblical text for this idea, they didn't need Elihu. There are plenty of other places where you could find the concept.
But if I were Job, I couldn't keep still.
But they're saying that, I mean, one view is Job didn't actually hear this. This is something that's being put in afterwards. That would be one idea. Another idea, of course, is that going with the Maimonidean view of this, which is based in the Talmud, that the whole story is a parable. And this is here, it's not like Job is failing to respond. Job is as real as Elihu is. And that's a second possibility. A third possibility is, and we're going to see this in the section that we're about to start, that Elihu is meant to introduce God's speeches. And therefore, there can't be a break for Job to respond in the book, because then you'll lose that flow. Because it's true. The last bit of Elihu is going to flow right into the speeches that God provides from the whirlwind. So, you know, there are various explanations for why Job isn't responding. The Karakemach, Rabbeinu Bahaye, we read back in the beginning of chapter 32, I think it was then, says that that Job isn't responding because Job agrees with him. That Job actually accepts what he's saying. So there are multiple views of this. Karen. I don't know. I'm waiting until I finish the book. Then I have the right to an opinion. Rita.
There is a philosophy that when people are in pain, like Job, that these situations are presented for the people around them to develop.
Yes.
Loving kindness, showing compassion.
Yeah.
And it's an opportunity for the people around them, like the friends, for example, to develop some qualities of people. And that God is judging them by the way.
Right. It is another way of looking at it. There's an awful lot to be said for that as well, for and against. But I'm going to go further with this, I think, because God's waiting to speak, and Elihu is in the way. So, chapter 36, sentence 22 begins the rest of what Elihu has to say. What you can think of as his fifth speech. The theme is simple. God is mighty beyond human understanding, and the image that Elihu is going to use in order to convey that is the image of thunderstorms. He's going to talk about clouds, rain, lightning, a little bit of snow. That's going to be his image that he uses. It is an incredibly hard section to translate, possibly the hardest part of the book that I've seen in terms of just a long section that can be read in so many different ways with so many odd words. For the most part, what I'm going to present will be from Mitzudat David. As you'll see when you go down the sheet, I'm just going to present it using his approach. I chose his approach because of its consistency and its relative clarity and the way he tries to stick to the words. But really, you could take Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Ralbag, Malbim. You're going to get different approaches from each of them. Susan. Yeah, the Bildad thing in chapter 8.
This all tied back to the nature part that we had learned earlier?
So I don't think so. If you see a connection as we go through, you know, tell me. But I didn't really see it. I didn't really see one. No, it's true that they both use a nature image, but I wouldn't see any connection in terms of the message. So this poem is going to be different from everything Eliyahu has done so far. Until now, he has argued logically with Job's claims, or what he thinks Job's claims are. His points can be stated very simply. God communicates, God punishes, God reigns in corrupt leaders, God protects society, God helps. Now, he's going to turn to focus on divine might as expressed in thunderstorms. Lots of rain, lots of water imagery.
No rain, there's nothing. That's the big
true
thing in lots and lots of scripture.
Rain. True. Rain as something critical. Not only that, he's going to note that rain actually can function in two opposing ways. Right? On the one hand, rain is a helper. It provides life. It's a blessing. And it can also destroy. And we're going to see that here. Rain going in both directions. It has been noted, and I mentioned it a minute ago, that the rest of Elihu's speech really reflects the themes of God's final speeches. The emphasis on the gap between human being and God, the rhetorical challenges that Elihu is going to put to Job, and then God is going to put to Job, very similar challenges. But there's a lot going on here. He's trying a different approach fundamentally. Now, bring you from the Rambam, in Moreh Nevuchim, God of the Perplexed, in source number 4. He says, "Kol elu ha'inyanim." He's talking about what we're now about to see in the rest of Elihu's address. He says, "Kol elu ha'inyanim ha'isa kavana bahen she'elu ha'inyanim ha'nimtzim ba'olam ha'havaya ba'hefseid lo yagia da'atenu la'hasig eichus hitchadsham." He says, the goal that Elihu has in mentioning all of these different entities that we're going to see, the clouds, the lightning, the rain, the thunder, he says the goal is to show that these entities exist in a world of existence and deterioration. Things come into existence and things cease to exist. And we don't understand how they are renewed. Where are they coming from? How are they being created? Below the rain, the clouds, and so forth. Interestingly, we'll see that the Talmud is actually going to draw on Elihu's description in order to try to understand the water cycle. Like how it is that clouds are formed and where the water is coming from and how it rises up into the sky and how it rains down. It's very interesting. It's a whole passage in the Talmud. But but what he says is we don't grasp the details of what's going on. We don't get how they started to exist. And none of it resembles something we could create. I mean, we can evaporate things, right? And we can create sort of pseudo clouds, but creating on that scale, right? With all the technology that we have, frankly, we ain't there. So he says, what Ali was trying to say is, how could we expect that divine orchestration and supervision of these entities would resemble what we would orchestrate or what we would supervise? He says, what we are supposed to appreciate is that God is blind to nothing. If God is able to do all of this with the thunderstorms, if God can do this with the rain and the clouds and the lightning and manage that globally, you have to recognize that he's not missing anything. If there's something going on that you don't understand, it's because you lack that level of function that God has. But I want to be really careful with this. Because I want to explain what he's saying and what he's not saying. This is not a logical argument. It's not like all the other statements that I mentioned before. God helps, God communicates. He will nowhere in this section is he going to actually say the words, God grasps all of these things. You don't. So stop talking, Job. He doesn't ever say that in this section. That's been said before. We talked about can a person be more righteous than God, and so God is higher than, but that's not what he's doing here. And it took for me to read Newsom before I understood what Rambam was really getting at when he was showing us this. I'm sorry, but that's the truth. Take a look at number five. Newsom says, but really what she's doing is ultimately expressing what the Rambam said. She doesn't quote him, but nonetheless. This is not an argument from nature. She's actually referring here in her initial comments to a separate poem that she thinks is similar to this that appears in the work of Ben Sira, which is an apocryphal book. This is not an argument from nature. Rather, the work of the poem of Ben Sira is fundamentally its effort to communicate a sense of wonder, an effort in which it succeeds brilliantly. But what, one may ask, is the significance of wonder and the intentional cultivation of a sense of wonder? What is its role in the inculcation of wisdom? First, the very act of prolonged description, which is what you're going to see here, prolonged description of the thunderstorms. This is going to go on for a while. Is a type of discipline of attention with important effects. This discipline of description requires that the person bracket herself, that is to be provisionally absent to herself, as she focuses attention on the object to be described. Yet the person is not truly absent. Rather, her presence is concentrated in the act of contemplating and describing. She experiences herself in the emotion of delight or awe that results from the contemplation. In other words, this is somebody staring at a waterfall, or the thunderstorm, or whatever example you want to give, and not, I don't exist, but I exist in the recognition of what is there, and the feeling of admiration of that phenomenon, the feeling of wonder about it, is what Elihu is going for. And you'll see in the way that he describes the thunderstorm, you'll see this very, very clearly, I think. But that's point number one that she makes. Second, and related to this, the experience of wonder produced by such an exercise is fundamentally an experience of something other. Even familiar objects, when perceived as objects of wonder, are temporarily estranged, made new and surprising, right? When you suddenly stop to look and really look, you perceive features that, you know, normally you skip. You don't even notice, and you gain an appreciation that otherwise wouldn't have been there. Third, the kind of attention achieved in a state of wonder differs qualitatively. The ordinary subject object dichotomy is disrupted with the bracketing of the self, and what is gazed upon is seen in its essential goodness. In other words, you're looking at it differently because it's no longer me looking at whatever object I use or whatever object is my landmark or whatever it is, but the focus is really on that entity and its own value. Its own value for what it is. Not what it is because of the way it relates to me, but what it is itself, and the last couple of words, its essential goodness, are, I think, in some ways the key to all of it. The idea that whatever it is that has been created has an essential goodness about it. I would take this and sort of shift it and add a step to it and say, you know, imagine the person who is out, you know, walking in the woods, and suddenly is attacked by a lion, but he's able to stop for a moment and admire the essential goodness of the lion. The beauty of it, the strength of it, the coordination of the muscles beneath its skin, the hair of the mane of the lion. I understand why people don't do that. Or at least if they do, they don't write it down for us to find out, because, you know, but that's what Elihu is summoning Job to do, is to see the world around him and to appreciate it as a thing of intricate beauty and immense power, and not as a logical argument of God made this, ergo God is wonderful, but to feel God made this, God is wonderful. Yes, I think it is Yirat Hashem. I think you hit it right on the head. It's an experience of I'm going to get to you. I know you want to say something. It's an experience of awe. It's an experience of reverence. It reminds me of I spoke in Shul on Rosh Hashanah a few years ago about the Enlightenment and the death of the Enlightenment. What brought the European Enlightenment to an end? And there are, papers and papers written on the topic. But one of the key realizations is that intellectual growth will only take you so far. And there are other dimensions of the human being and other dimensions of knowledge and rightness, so to speak, beyond that which you can get by reading a book and studying a formula and so forth. And that, of course, gives birth ultimately to Romanticism, which had its own flaws. But the
Romanticism is the leap to faith.
Possibly. But that's exactly what Elihu is promoting. He's promoting this kind of Romanticism where you're going to, I'm thinking sort of like Misnagdim Chasidim. You're going from, these Misnagdish visitors who, I apologize for those who aren't familiar with Misnagid, but boy, would that take a long time to explain. How the mainstream became the opposition. The sort of dry intellectual, I'm gonna do my best. The dry intellectual. Yeah. So don't listen. The going from the dry intellectualism, sort of the academy, to the person who finds God by wandering in the woods. That's really what this is, what this change is. Elihu here has jumped ship from the academic and from the intellectual and is now going to find himself in the world of the romantic, who says, thunderstorms are so wonderful. And that's what he's going to spend the next chapter and a half telling us as a demonstration of what God is. Paul, you've been so patient.
Yes. Well, the historian says don't read history backwards.
Yes.
In other words, don't project our understanding and our values onto the past. This has to be read in its own time.
Right.
Because there's a 21st century person who knows that you don't need God for weather systems.
Well, I think you would argue, you don't need him to manage them, you need him to start them. But go ahead. There are a whole lot of planets out there that don't have them.
You don't need God's weather systems.
Okay.
That can happen independently of the need for God. So knowing that, this whole thing is altered, you can still have a sense of awe at how it happens, but it wouldn't necessarily inspire a sense of God in a 21st century person. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
So you have to project yourself back into the distant past to make that argument relevant.
Yes and no.
Or effective.
Yes and no. The reason I say yes and no is not to argue your basic point. I agree with your basic point. But realistically, number one, we are all aware, I think, of analogous cases in our world that we have yet to explain and that will inspire that kind of wonder of we can't do that, number one. Number two, for all of our ability to explain some of the details, we still can't explain all of the details. And the evidence of that, just turn on the radio any given day. And the weather, we're not even asking them to create it. We're just asking them to predict it. We're asking them to tell us what's going on outside right now.
To this
point. The reality is that the fact that we're able to drop a couple of rules about the way evaporation works does not mean we understand the way the weather works. And the proof of it is there every day. But most of all, it doesn't have to work as an image outside of the time of the people who are having the conversation. It doesn't need to. Shane has been waiting. Yeah.
I have many things, but just issue. You can be a meteorologist and still walk outside and stand on your porch and say,
Correct.
That's a human experience.
That's a human experience, but it doesn't necessarily in the 20th century evoke in a 21st century person the sense that this is from God.
But it doesn't exclude it.
It doesn't exclude it.
I think the question is when you have that experience.
And I say that as a person of faith, but I still say it doesn't. The faith no longer comes from that kind of experience, necessarily.
I'll grant you necessarily. I'm thinking about Maimonides, who says that when he says Hashem Pai Photo, he says that's why you have to learn math and astronomy, so that you can understand exactly how the heavens explain how the heavens tell God's glory.
Right. I mean, I'll give a an example of that, just because on Sunday morning I gave a shiur for doctors on stress. Stress in Jewish law, or as I've come to think of it, stress in Jewish law and autobiography. In preparing it, I went through a lot of medical literature on the way the body responds to stress. It is unbelievable, and I use that word specifically, it is unbelievable the orchestration of different systems and what actually happens in the body when a person perceives a source of stress, whether you're talking about the immune system working in two opposite directions, on the one hand releasing cytokines to help it fight off infection, and on the other hand reducing and suppressing its response in order to direct metabolic resources elsewhere within the body. On the one hand, you have the brain focusing and actually producing new connections and neurons to be able to deal with the problem at hand, but on the other hand, redirecting those resources away from other aspects of the brain. It reduces neuroplasticity. It does all sorts of things which, like, you think a brain can't do in terms of the way it develops and the way it focuses its resources. Within the body itself, it starts metabolizing fat and protein in order to provide energy for the fight or flight response. Different enzymes are being released. There's a lot. There's a lot more to say about it. My point is, understanding those things doesn't make me appreciate less the magnificence of the system. It makes me appreciate much more. And frankly, evolutionary questions are fascinating, but that's not the topic for right now.
Doesn't cure you either.
Doesn't cure you either. Correct. But the point that I'm making is that piggybacking on what Shana was saying, is that knowledge of how it works doesn't have to reduce appreciation for the beauty of it.
I understand what you're saying, but I think if you were to talk to an atheistic evolutionary biologist, he would just explain that through evolution.
Yeah, it's not a question of I understand now where the disconnect is in terms of what I'm saying and the response. I'm not, and I think Shana is not, and I know Elihu is not. None of the parties involved in this conversation, so to speak, from the book side, is saying, look at the thunderstorm, it proves there's a God. That's not his point. No, it's saying, look at the thunderstorm and recognize the wonder, feel the wonder of this world. If someone doesn't accept that there is a God, nothing Elihu is going to say, and nothing anybody is going to say, is going to prove something to the contrary. But Elihu is speaking to Job, and Job 100% believes there's a God. If he didn't, he wouldn't be yelling and screaming.
Yeah.
Right? We've seen that from the start of the book. Job is a ma'amin like no other. He absolutely believes. He has believed from day one, and he will believe until the end. And that's not what Elihu's job is.
Okay, but he's conceived that for a 21st century person with the knowledge of science, that this is a different challenge.
Yeah, it's an entirely different challenge. It's orthogonal to the book. Orthogonal to the book. Meaning that it's a completely different question. And the question of whether you can be brought to faith by argument in general is I think, an important discussion in its own right. But yeah, now I understand that we're answering two different questions. Yeah.
So if he's not trying to alter Job's thinking, what's
right.
the purpose of it?
Right. So what he's trying to do is not to alter Job's thinking, but to alter Job's experience. What he wants Job to do is to look around and see the wonders of the world and to
Job's
feel.
Job's experienced the wonders of the world.
Who says?
From it.
Who says?
At the beginning.
How do we know? No, no, no. Having wealth and family doesn't mean he has experienced the wonders of the world in this way. Mind you, I'm not endorsing Eliezer's approach as a good idea. I have another source to bring on that. But the point is that Elihu is coming at this from the perspective of live this, and you will come to a different appreciation of the world. That's what Elihu is trying to say.
So he is trying to change too.
Right, but not his thinking. Changing his... this isn't a logical argument. This is, I want you to experience things the way that I do. That's what... But we'll see. And again, whether this is a good idea or not is waiting on a source I want to bring, but we're not ready for it yet. So, there's more to be said. But this is what Elihu wants to do. Elihu wants to have Job witness that which is wonderful in creation. And you should just be really, really happy that he's only going to take the thunderstorm and not decide that he wants to talk about everything else. Because this is now going to be his theme for the rest of his speech. Let's get to it. We have some time still. So, sentence 22 is our start. He begins with a point that we've seen said before by Elihu as well as Eliphaz. Hein kel yas giv b'chocho, mi kamohu moreh. Now again, you all have translations of one kind or another in front of you. Please do not quote them. I'm working with Mitzudat David. I am aware that the Art Scroll will render it differently. I haven't looked at the Sansino, but I'm pretty sure that they will render it differently as well. That's fine. If you want to compare Gesunde 8, but I've looked at all the various commentaries I have access to, and they're all going to take you in different directions and just confuse it. So he says, Hein kel yas giv b'kocho. God is mighty in his strength. Mi chamohu moreh. Moreh meaning to warn. Who is like God in warning others? And what that means, if you take a look at the Midrash, which is what I think is informing Mitzudat David on this point, source number 6, a contrast between human beings and God. Basar v'adam shu mevakesh lahavi ra'a al sona'o pit'om evi alava shelo yargishbo. Flesh and blood who wish to harm an enemy do so suddenly, so that he's not going to realize it. V'akadosh Baruch Hu, God on the other hand, he warned Pharaoh of each plague so that he would repent. Right? He's giving the example from Egypt. Now, the truth is, Pharaoh does not get warnings for each plague. We know the cycle of how it works, and there are three of them that he's not warned. Nonetheless, the general point that the Midrash is making is God's power is such that he warns people before he does anything. That's the Midrash. Mitzudat David actually also offers I broke my own rule. I said I was only going to do Mitzudat David. This Midrash is actually what Rashi uses. I brought it anyway, sorry. The Mitzudat David's approach is a different one. He says that Moreh is to cast down or to throw. Like in Chumash, Yaro Yireh would be one example of it. Sus v'ro chvo, no, that's Ramah. But there's also Yara, Yarabaya. But take a look at Mitzudat David, which I brought you in source number 7. Halo b'kocho harav, with his great might, yechazek v'yiromeim es asher yashar be'enav. He strengthens and elevates those who are righteous in his eyes. There's no one like God who will cast below the one he wishes. Everything is in his hand to help or to harm, either way. God does either one. This is his introduction to the storm that he's going to bring in. He has a few verses of introduction. Mifakad, back in sentence 23. Mifakad olav darko, who has commanded God in his ways? Umi amar pa'alta avla, who can say to God what you did was wrong? Job had his hand up. I can. Zechor kisas gifa alo, remember that his deeds, God's deeds, are great, are mighty. Asher shoriru anashim. This is a funny word. Asher shoriru anashim. Shoriru means what? Lashir, to sing. But it can also mean, as it has been used frequently by Elihu, to see. Right. Ashurenu velo karov would be one example, but you could bring many. So that most of the commentators say this should be read as, remember, the word sentence 24, remember his deeds are great, that the deeds that people observe, shoreru anashim, that people see. However, hold on one second, Dad Mikra and others say no. This is actually the deeds of which people sing, and that the verses that are coming up that are going to describe the thunderstorm are actually a popular poem. He's showing you the song people sing regarding the might displayed and the beauty displayed in the thunderstorm. Yes, Susan?
When you said it means song and it means sea, does it have the same charge?
Yes. Well, no, I'm sorry. It has the same letters, but they're fundamentally different words. Well, right. So I don't know what the three-letter root would be. I would have to look up. It's a good question. So he says, remember that God's deeds are mighty, these deeds that everybody sees or that everybody sings of. And he says in Pasuk Chav Hey, sentence 25, Kol Adam Chazuvo, everybody gazes upon these things. Enosh yabit merachok, people look upon them from afar. From afar could mean distance, and from afar could mean across time, throughout history. Both are offered by the commentaries. And here he begins the song, according to those who say that this is a song. And you can hear the rhythm of it in the Hebrew. Hey nekel sagi velo neda, mispar shanav velo cheker. God is Sagi, there's that word, he saw Tasgi in sentence 24. God is mighty, and we will not know, meaning we don't know the extent of his might. Mispar Shanav, the number of his years, we don't know. Velo Cheker, we cannot know that either. We don't know how old God is. We cannot grasp his might, and we cannot grasp his age. Ki yigara nitfe mayim yazoku matar le'edo. Ki yigara nitfe mayim. He rains down drops of water. This is the rain starting. Yazoku matar le'edo. The rain yazoku le'edo. Those are both words that are hard to render. Yazoku is taken by many commentaries to mean purification. And aid is either the time God sets for it, or is, what else could it be?
Vapor.
In Bereshit, ve'ed ya'alem in ha'aretz, right? The mist descended from the ground. So, yazoku matar le'edo, the rain is purified by his clouds. The images of the clouds as like not only the raindrops themselves, but as like a receptacle from which they filter down, is the way that it's being presented here. Asher yizlu shechakim, the clouds flow with water. Yirafu alei adam rav, they will rain down. And yirafu is already a stronger term; it suggests raining down with force. The alei adam rav upon a great many people. So he's describing for you drip, drip of water filtered down from the clouds, then the clouds sending rain in greater force, and then it really raining down hard upon a great many people. And this is, by the way, those verses are the ones I mentioned before that the Talmud, it's Tanit 9b for those who want to look it up, but the Talmud goes through those verses trying to figure out the water cycle. Where is the water coming from, and how is it rising up to the heavens and so forth. Af im yavin mifrasei av. Actually, you know what? I'm going to stop with that rather than run into it, because now he's going to start him with lightning, and that's going to bring on its own element. So what we've seen today is, number one, the conclusion of sort of his fourth point, which was the statement that suffering can actually be good for you, it can be helpful, it can warn you, and so forth. And we start on his last point, which is building a sense of wonder for Job when he looks at the world as a way to change his outlook, not by logical argument, but by experience. And we'll see more of that, God willing, next week. Hopefully, what I would like to do, since next week is the last week before Pesach, so I expect we will finish this speech and begin the question that we have to contemplate of what is God doing here when God comes in to speak to Job for the last part of the book. I also hope to update the outline that I sent out in the beginning of the year that had like where we've been, so that it'll be up to date with where we are now. Thank you very much.